am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Welcome back, my friend. Last time I told you about Stephen Barsudeli, a Syrian monk from the 5th century who went searching so deep into the mystery of God that the church of his day wasn't quite sure what to do with him. I find myself still thinking about him, about what it costs a person to follow a question all the way to its end. Today I want to take you somewhere else entirely. A different century, a different language, a different kind of pressure. But the same restless hunger. The same turning inward towards something that the outer world cannot give and cannot take away. We are going to 16th century Spain, and I want to show you something I watched, a moment in a small room that stayed with me for a very long time. I think you'll understand why. I was there. I want you to know that before I say anything else, I was in that room. I was standing in the corner where the light didn't quite reach, and I watched the whole thing, and I have never forgotten it. The room was small. Church buildings in Castile have a particular smell. Old stone, candle smoke, ink, the faint sweetness of incense that never quite leaves the walls. There was a table, two chairs, a man with documents arranged in front of him like weapons he hadn't decided whether to use yet, and a woman sitting across from him with her hands folded in her lap, perfectly still. He was furious. I could see it in the way he held himself, that rigid, careful fury of a man who cannot afford to shout but very much wants to. He, the authority of the Spanish Inquisition, he had procedure. He had the full weight of an institution that had, in recent memory, made kings uncomfortable. He was not accustomed to being met with silence. He kept asking his questions. She kept answering, quietly, simply, without evasion. And yet somehow he was getting nothing. Everything she gave him was true and told him nothing about the thing he was actually reaching for. He could feel it there, something in her that he couldn't name, couldn't locate, couldn't touch. It was maddening him. She wasn't defying him. That's what I want you to understand. She wasn't performing courage. She wasn't gritting her teeth behind that serene expression. She was simply elsewhere. Present in the room, yes. Answering his questions, yes. But the part of her that he actually wanted was somewhere he did not have a map to. I had seen interrogations before. I had watched across centuries the many ways human beings try to reach inside one another by force, with threats, with promises, with the slow, cold machinery of institutional power. I knew what it looked like when a person was hiding, when they were lying, when they were frightened into stillness. This was none of those things. This woman had found a room inside herself, and she had learned, through practice, through devotion, through the long, patient work of turning her attention inward, to live there, not to visit it when she was afraid, to live there. So that when a man with documents and fury and the authority of the church sat across from her and reached for her soul, he found only the outer rooms. Pleasant enough, perfectly in order, nothing of consequence. The thing he wanted was further in, and there was no door he could open to get there. He dismissed her eventually. I watched her walk out into the Castilian afternoon, back into the noise of the street, the smell of the market, the ordinary complicated life of a woman in 16th century Spain. She didn't look relieved. She didn't look triumphant. She just looked like herself. I stayed in that room a little longer. The Inquisitor was gathering his documents, frowning at something he couldn't quite articulate in his notes. I almost felt sorry for him. Almost. He had just met Recogimiento, and he hadn't even known what to call it. Let me tell you about the world that made her. Spain in the early 16th century was a place of extraordinary tension. The Reconquista, 7 centuries of Christian kingdoms pushing southward against Muslim rule, had finally concluded in 1492. The same year, you may remember, that Columbus sailed west and everything changed. But the conclusion of the Reconquista didn't bring the peace that people might have hoped for. It brought a particular kind of anxious triumphalism, a nation newly unified by faith and therefore newly suspicious of anyone whose faith might be impure. The Inquisition had been operating since 1478. I want to be careful here, because people often picture it as nothing but dungeons and horror. And while there was certainly horror, the everyday reality was something more bureaucratic and in some ways more insidious. It was a system of scrutiny, of records and reports and neighborhood whispers, of limpieza de sangre, purity of blood, a doctrine that tracked your ancestry looking for Jewish or Muslim roots, because conversion, apparently, was not always considered sufficient. You could be a Christian for 3 generations and still be watched. Into this world of watched lives and measured words, something quietly extraordinary began to happen among a circle of Franciscan friars and the lay people around them. They began to teach a method of prayer that was not about words at all. The movement had a name, recogimiento, recollection, gathering oneself inward. The man who gave it its clearest voice was a Franciscan friar named Francisco de Osuna. In 1527, he published a book called The Third Spiritual Alphabet, and I watched that book move through Spain the way a candle moves through a dark room. Quietly, one hand passing it to another, Teresa of Avila, a young woman in Avila, not yet the great reformer history would know her as, read it and said it changed everything for her. She would spend the rest of her life building on what she found inside it. But recogimiento wasn't only for learned friars and future saints. That was precisely the point. The badas, lay women who had taken informal religious vows but lived in the world rather than in convents, practiced it in cities and market towns. Women who had no institutional standing, no formal authority, no protection from scrutiny. They practiced it anyway. They taught each other. They sat together in ordinary rooms and turned their attention inward toward God, without a priest to mediate, without a liturgy to follow, with nothing but the long, patient discipline of the turned mind. The church watched this with considerable unease. There was another movement in Spain at the time, the Alumbrados, the Illuminated Ones, who claimed direct spiritual experience in ways that alarmed the Inquisition considerably. Recogimiento was different, more disciplined, more orthodox in its intentions. But the lines between movements were not always clear to men with documents and questions. If you were a woman practicing interior prayer without institutional supervision in 16th century Castile, you were already in interesting territory. I walked through those cities, Salamanca, Toledo, Avila, Seville. I watched people carry this practice inside them the way you carry something precious in a crowd. Carefully, close to the chest, not drawing attention. A grandmother teaching her granddaughter to sit still and go inward. A merchant's wife rising before dawn to practice the gathered silence before the household woke. A beata in a modest room explaining to a young woman that the kingdom of God was not somewhere you traveled to. It was somewhere you learned to be. The world outside was loud with history. Inside, something very quiet was happening. I want you to understand what it cost them. Not just the risk of the Inquisition's attention, though that was real enough. I mean the interior cost. The discipline of recogimiento was not comfortable or easy. It asked something profound of a person, and what it asked was this: stop. In a world that gave you every reason to keep moving, keep performing, keep demonstrating your orthodoxy and your loyalty and your purity of blood, stop. Turn away from all of it. Go inward. For the people practicing this in 16th century Castile, that turning inward was an act of extraordinary spiritual courage. Here is what they believed, and I watched them believe it with everything they had. They believed that God was not primarily found in the outer world, not in the liturgy, not in the sacraments, not in the pronouncements of authority, though they honored all of those things carefully, because they were not fools. They believed that beneath all of that, underneath the performed religion of a watch society, there was a place in the human soul where God was simply present. Waiting, not waiting impatiently, just there. The way light is there when you open a shutter. You didn't create it, you just had to learn to open. Recogimiento was the practice of opening. Francisco de Osuna described it as gathering the scattered forces of the soul. We spend our days, he wrote, with our attention flying in 100 directions, toward worry, toward ambition, toward the opinions of others, toward fear. The recogido learns to call all of that back, gently, patiently, without violence, toward the wandering mind. You notice that you have scattered, you gather yourself, you return, and in that returning, something waits for you. I want you to feel what this meant for a converso family in Toledo, people whose grandparents had converted from Judaism, who lived under the constant low hum of suspicion, whose outer lives were a careful performance of belonging. For them, the outer world of religious life was complicated in ways I cannot fully describe to you. Every public prayer carried the weight of being watched. Every feast day was also a test. The whole elaborate structure of public Christianity was both sincere and strategic, and they were never allowed to forget the strategic part. And then someone hands them Osuna's book, or a beata sits with them and explains quietly that there is a prayer that happens in silence, that goes beneath language, that requires no performance because there is no audience. He could regulate her outer life. He could not follow her inward. Nobody could. That was the whole point. Here is what I have watched happen across the long centuries when a spiritual idea finds its moment. It spreads. Not always loudly, not always in the ways its first practitioners imagined. Sometimes it goes underground for a generation and surfaces somewhere unexpected, wearing different clothes, speaking a different language, but carrying the same seed. I have seen this enough times that it no longer surprises me, but it still moves me. Recogimiento did this. The most visible line runs straight to two people whose names you may already know, and if you don't, I promise you will want to. Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. Two Carmelite reformers in 16th century Spain who took the interior tradition that Recogimiento had nurtured and built from it, something that the whole world's spiritual imagination would eventually inherit. Teresa was a young woman in a convent in Avila when she first read Francisco de Osuna. She would later describe that encounter the way people describe finding water when they didn't know they were thirsty. She spent decades developing what she called the interior castle, a map of the soul's journey inward through successive rooms toward the still center where God waits. The architecture was different. The vocabulary was richer, more elaborate, harder won, but the essential claim was the same one the Beatas had been practicing in ordinary rooms a generation earlier. The most real thing about you is your interior life. And your interior life has a depth that most people never reach because most people never try. John of the Cross wrote poetry about it. I have always loved that about him. When the deepest truths exceeded his theology, he reached for metaphor. The Dark Night of the Soul, his most famous image, describes the passage through interior emptiness that Recogimiento practitioners knew well, the silence that feels like absence before it reveals itself as presence. The gathered soul waiting in the dark, learning that the dark itself is full. These two figures carried the interior tradition into the permanent record of human spiritual history. Their writings were read across Europe. They shaped Carmelite spirituality for centuries. They were eventually declared Doctors of the Church, the institution that had watched their predecessors with such suspicion, eventually claiming them as its own treasures. History has a sense of humor, I have noticed, but I don't want you to think that Recogimiento's contribution was only these two luminous names. The deeper gift was the idea itself, planted quietly in the soil of a very particular historical moment and proving surprisingly durable. The idea is this: that the human soul has an interior dimension that is not the product of culture or institution or language or fear. that this interior dimension is accessible through practice, not through extraordinary grace granted to exceptional people, but through the ordinary discipline of turning attention inward day after day in whatever room you happen to be in. That this practice connects a person to something real, something that was there before the noise started and will be there after it stops. I have seen versions of this idea in places very far from 16th century Castile. I watched Buddhist monks in China sit in precisely this quality of gathered silence centuries before Asuna wrote a word. I saw Sufi practitioners in Persia describe the inward turn with a different vocabulary and the same essential gesture. I have watched Jewish mystics, Hindu contemplatives, indigenous elders in traditions with no written theology at all of them pointing with their different hands toward the same interior country. I am not saying these traditions are the same. They are not, and they would not thank me for flattening their differences, but I am saying that humanity keeps rediscovering this, keeps finding, in very different circumstances and languages and centuries, that there is something inward worth turning toward, that the interior life is not a luxury or an eccentricity, that it is, in some sense that is hard to argue and easy to feel, the most fundamental thing about us. Recogimiento's particular gift to that long conversation was to say it clearly in a specific time and place, under specific pressure, when the people who needed to hear it most were living watched lives in a watched society. It said there is somewhere they cannot follow you, and that somewhere is not an escape, it is your truest home. That idea did not stay in Spain. It did not stay in the 16th century. It moved, as true things tend to do, through time and across borders, finding new voices and new moments and new people who needed exactly that particular piece of good news. It is still moving. I want to tell you something that I think gets lost. When people hear about contemplative practice, about interior prayer, about the deliberate cultivation of stillness, there is a tendency to hear it as a kind of withdrawal, a turning away from the world and its demands. Something for monks and mystics and people with the luxury of quiet lives. Not for the rest of us, out here in the noise, trying to get things done. I have watched this misunderstanding cause real harm, because it leaves people with a false choice. Either you engage fully with the world and abandon the interior life, or you tend the interior life and withdraw from the world. And most people faced with that choice choose engagement. Of course they do. The world is urgent. The world is loud. The world keeps asking. But that is not the choice the Riquidos were making. Teresa of Avila was not a woman who retreated from the world. I watched her. She reformed the Carmelite order across Spain, founding convent after convent against institutional resistance that would have broken most people. She negotiated with bishops, argued with theologians, managed construction projects, handled money, navigated the politics of a church that was simultaneously her home and her obstacle. She wrote letters, hundreds of them, practical and sharp and sometimes very funny, while also writing some of the most profound mystical literature in the history of Christianity. She did all of this while practicing the interior life with a discipline that never wavered. The interior practice was not what she did instead of the outer work. It was what made the outer work possible. John of the Cross rebuilt broken communities, went into situations of real institutional wreckage, and quietly, patiently put things back together. The Dark Night of the Soul was not a poem about giving up. It was a map of the passage through interior emptiness that a person must make in order to come out the other side, carrying something real. Something that doesn't collapse under pressure. Something that a furious inquisitor cannot confiscate. Here is what I believe, having watched a very long time. The person who does not know how to go inward is at the mercy of every external force that wants to define them. The algorithm that profiles your preferences. The culture that tells you what to want. The institution that tells you what to think. The noise that tells you who you are by what it can measure about you. Without an interior life, you are entirely legible to these systems and entirely at their mercy. The fury of that inquisitor in the small stone room, I keep coming back to it. He represented a system that wanted complete knowledge of the people under its authority, complete reach, and he encountered in one quietly composed woman the absolute limit of what external systems can do. She was not resisting him. She was simply inhabited. She lived somewhere he could not follow, and so the thing he wanted most was simply not available to him. That is not passivity. That is a form of freedom so deep it looks like stillness from the outside. We live now in a world that is extraordinarily good at reaching inward, at filling silence before it can become anything, at providing in every quiet moment something to look at, something to react to, something to consume. The Inquisitor has no face now. It is not a man with documents in a small stone room. It is 1,000 gentle, convenient, beautifully designed systems that would very much like to know what is in your interior rooms, that profit from knowing, that are specifically engineered to make the turning inward feel unnecessary, uncomfortable, slightly strange. And most of us, most of the time, let them in. I am not saying this to make you feel bad. I am saying it because I have watched what happens to people who remember that there is somewhere those systems cannot follow, who practice in whatever form fits their life and their tradition and their temperament, the old discipline of recollection, of gathering the scattered self back inward, of sitting, even for a few minutes, in the room that has no door, the world can open. They come back different, not detached, not otherworldly, more present, actually, more capable of real engagement, real service, real love, because they are drawing from a source that the outer world did not give them and cannot take away. The soul's interior is not under anyone's jurisdiction but your own. It never has been. The Beatas knew this. Teresa knew this. The woman in that small stone room in Castile knew this with such complete certainty that a furious man with all the authority of his institution could not find so much as a crack in her composure. The room is still there. It has always been there. Whatever the world outside is doing, however loud, however urgent, however well-designed its systems for reaching you, that room remains. Quiet. Waiting. Yours. You just have to remember to go there. So here's what I want to leave with you just for a moment before we move on. I want to ask you something, and I don't need you to answer out loud. This one is just for you. When did you last go somewhere no one could follow? Not a vacation, not a distraction, not the particular numbness that comes from staring at a screen until the noise inside you quiets down. I mean the real thing. The deliberate turning inward, the gathering of your scattered self back toward its own center. Even for 5 minutes, even imperfectly, even without knowing exactly what you were turning toward. Can you remember the last time? I ask because I notice watching the people I care about move through their lives. And I do care about you. I hope you know that by now. I notice how rarely anyone gives themselves permission to stop. Really stop. Not because they are lazy or indifferent to their own interior life, but because the world has become so skilled at making stopping feel irresponsible, like there is always something more urgent. Always a reason to keep the outward motion going just a little longer. The Recogidos would recognize this. They lived in a world that also had very good reasons to keep moving. Very compelling arguments for why interior stillness was a luxury, a risk, a suspicious activity better avoided. They practiced anyway. In ordinary rooms, before ordinary days, they gathered themselves inward and found that the gathering itself was a kind of answer, that the soul has a center, and the center holds, and returning to it again and again, imperfectly, faithfully, changes something about how you move through everything else. You don't have to call it recogimiento. You don't have to call it anything. The name is not the point and never was. The point is the room. The point is that it exists. The point is that it is yours, genuinely, completely, irreducibly yours, in a way that very little else in your life actually is. I wonder what you would find there if you went. I wonder what is already waiting. Next time, I want to tell you about a man named William Wilberforce. He was born in England in 1759 into comfort and privilege and every reason to live a pleasant, undemanding life. And for a while, he did exactly that. But something happened to him in his mid-20s, a slow, quiet interior transformation that he described in his journals with a candor that I found watching it unfold, genuinely moving. He went inward. And what he found there would not let him rest. He spent the next 45 years of his life fighting to end the British slave trade, not from the outside, not as a revolutionary, but from inside the very institutions that sustained it, Parliament, society, the established order. He lost repeatedly for decades, and kept going because the source he was drawing from was not the kind that runs dry when the outer world stops cooperating. I think you will find when we get there that you already know something about where that source comes from. But that is for next time. For now, thank you. For sitting with me in that small stone room in Castile. For staying with the woman who knew where to go when the world reached too far. For remembering, even for a moment, that there is somewhere they cannot follow you. Go there when you can. Go there often. Go there especially on the days when the world makes it feel impossible. It will be worth it. I promise you it will be worth it. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read every one. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.